Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review. This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 416 for comics originally released on July 29th, 2015. Now, starting us off in DC is Batgirl Annual number 3. Now, this came out the same week as Batgirl number 42, and the stories don't really seem to connect in any way that it really matters what order you read them in. At least as far as I could tell, having read the other one first and then this.
Does that bother you at all? I mean, in my mind, Annual should be relegated to like a fifth week, you know, a fifth week month, or at the very least when the actual title's not coming out. I just don't like it when it's coming out at the same time.
You know, I was thinking about that a little earlier today, because I'm always trying to think, how can I rework my number crunching stuff? And, you know, it's bad enough when an issue and an annual come out in the same week. We've also had the rare occasion where two issues come out in the same week, and I'm wondering, you know, would it be possible for two issues for a title that's kind of backed up and switching story arcs and therefore has another creative team on that second issue to come out at the same time the annual did? And I'm thinking, you know, it's just a matter of time. I think having two issues of the same comic, even including an annual, special, whatever, is just a bad idea. And if you're going to do 13 at DC, they would do, you know, 12 issues and an annual, so 13 over the course of the year. Space them out every 4 weeks. Now, that may be a little tough on the regular monthly artist or whatever, but you kind of slot in the schedule ahead of time where that annual is going to lie, build it up to where it's either the end of a story arc, between story arcs, or whatever. And that's how it used to be at times. This goes to kind of the other kind of old school approach to annuals, where it's just an extra length story that you wouldn't have had room for in a regular issue. So it didn't bother me too much that I got, you know, more Batgirl this week, but I'd have been just as happy if this had come out 2 weeks from now or 2 weeks ago, kind of between issues of Batgirl. And I think it would have been better for the title that way.
Yeah, let's say you're a Batgirl fan, and that's the only thing you buy, and you budgeted $5 a month for that, and that's and now you're, I don't know, it just bothers me.
I like the idea of it being a fifth week kind of a deal, but the problem with that is, you know, X number of titles at DC and Marvel, if they all did that, then if it was literally a fifth week, a month that had a fifth week, then four times a year you just get slammed with this, oh my god, you know, 15 titles have an annual this week. I mean, as it was, we had Batgirl, we had Lobo, we had Gotham.
Academy.
I mean, we had a bunch of annuals all over.
Yeah.
Us. You know, so, or maybe that was, actually, I'm behind on my reading. I may be thinking a month ago. I think I was early in July. Anyways, you get weeks where you have too many annuals all at once.
Yeah, that's true. That doesn't make them as special.
So, if you've got around 52 books, like DC sometimes has, why not have an annual every week and just kind of rotate through it or something? And do it where it's an off week for the book, you know, and take what normally would have been a 4 week, you know, thing between issues and go 5 weeks with it in the middle, or go, you know, exactly four and have the annual be there.
Well, not everybody gets an annual, and some people get three or four.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense to me either.
I mean, I would think you'd want to get to 12 issues before you get to it, before you release an annual. So that might be harder and harder to do in the future.
And that also would have been a problem with the new 52, because all of them would have dropped at once.
Yeah.
This is one where it was a self-contained story. You can read it more or less at any point after she switches costumes. It didn't really kind of lock into any period. And what I liked...
Post Forever Evil.
Yeah, post Forever... Well, post her new costume, which is post Forever Evil. So, yeah. But I liked it. It was a fairly straightforward story. The plot is almost a bit of a MacGuffin or whatever. It's just a means to allow Batgirl to interact with other Batman family characters. And the lead story here I thought was really good, featuring Grayson and Helena from the Grayson title, and how, you know, that interaction kind of plays out. It's one of the few times Dick Grayson is back in Gotham. And of course, everyone post Forever Evil is thinking he's dead. So how does that play out? And it seemed like something, it's like, ooh, I like these characters. That might be enough to get people into that other title. whether it succeeds or not, don't know. I liked how we had a chapter kind of after that, more of almost a backup length kind of a deal, with Spoiler. Now, she's gone from kind of recently introduced in Batman Eternal, showing up a little over in Catwoman, to essentially feeling here like she's the pre-New 52 version almost. And I got mixed feelings about that, but she was well used here in a character that fits with Batgirl's kind of, you know, the take they're doing on her now. Follow that by another chapter with her interacting with Batwoman. And of course, every time we're switching chapters, we're switching art styles to be kind of evocative of that book, particularly with Batwoman, and then the final chapter with Gotham Academy, where Batgirl meets Maps and Olive from there. So the art shifting was a little, not jarring, but clearly that they were trying to evoke the style of those other books as if these are samplers for that stuff. And it's a way to take people who are reading one title and get them interested in another, both in terms of Batgirl readers maybe being curious now to check out Grayson, Batwoman, and Gotham Academy, and potentially getting readers of those titles to sample this annual and hopefully start to like Batgirl and follow that. So from a cross-marketing move, I think it's a good approach. Again, the story here facilitates and makes that interaction feel natural, even though, I mean, arguably it was kind of forced, but it at least didn't read that way. I enjoyed it. Is this something that is an absolute must-get or something? No. You could skip over this, read just the monthly stuff, and not miss anything overall. But I thought it was a good read. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm right with you. It was really good. I was surprised that I liked it as well as I did. It was really a good annual, and it reminded me a little of when Nightwing, the first volume of Nightwing, number 4, I believe it was a Batgirl Nightwing crossover, and retailers didn't order enough of that, so it was in high demand because both Nightwing folks wanted it, and the Batgirl folks wanted it, and so it's still kind of artificially inflated in price, and it's hard to get. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if they learned their lesson that time, and since they knew that this was coming, they put a few extra on the shelves so that both the Grayson fans and the Batgirl fans would be able to fill out their runs with this if they wanted to, for the completionist collectors out there. I hope they did.
I think for those two titles, they probably did, because, I mean, part of what got me excited about this is knowing it was going to be a crossover with Grayson.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was pleasantly surprised to get Spoiler, Batwoman, and the Gotham Academy stuff in this, too.
Yeah, I was, too. I didn't see that coming, and it worked. It worked pretty well. I was surprised how it didn't feel really that forced, and it was interesting to see that. I'm not reading Gotham Academy, and those kids were interesting, almost enough to make me want to check it out. So let's score one, marketing person. Good job.
I would say before doing that, reread that chapter in kind of a Garfield minus Garfield kind of an approach, which is a comic strip where somebody took the Garfield stuff and removed Garfield, and, you know, the lead character just seems kind of sad without him. Read this one without Batgirl in it and see if you still like those characters.
Yeah, exactly.
Because she's not in Gotham Academy.
Right.
And it's not a bad book. It's a book that still perplexes me as to what they're trying to do and go with it. I think it's part of their diversity push, and I'm just not part of that audience that they're targeting there.
I was fearful that I was going to be jarred from one art style to the next because of the 3 or 4 different art teams on this. But it worked. It wasn't as bad. It wasn't as bad as I thought. And it seemed to, there it was a striking difference in the, especially in the Batgirl renderings. They were quite different.
Mm-hmm.
But it still was okay. They were still able to tell a story, and it wasn't too upsetting to see the roller coaster of artists we've woven through here. And I thought the story was good enough that it maintained a pretty good consistency throughout.
I think switching artists at the chapter break and the kind of guest star break made it feel a little less jarring because they were kind of natural chapters.
Yeah. But the last artist draws a significantly older Batgirl than the first one does.
The one with the Batwoman stuff, second to
yeah,
last.
Yeah,
yes. Yes. Yeah.
Significantly. She seems very old. Yeah, you're right. The the last version.
I mean, to me, the shift from the Batwoman chapter art to the Gotham Academy art was the biggest shift.
Mm-hmm.
Just because one's a more painted style, it doesn't have the black lines. The previous one with the Batwoman very much does. And both are good, you know, good art styles or whatever. It's just face to face on a page like that.
Yes.
If I were doing this, I might have tried to do it where there was a page flip to the new art, maybe, but I don't know if that would have worked either. You might have been flipped the page and it's like, wow, what happened here kind of thing. So art shifts like that are tricky to do well.
Mm-hmm.
And they did them decently here, given how different the art styles are.
Yeah, we have co-writers Cameron Stewart and Brendan Fletcher, and then we have a host of artists Bing Gao, David LaFuente, Bing Doyle, and Mingju Helen Chen on art. So that's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of artists and stuff, but you know, we get, I'm not sure how many pages this is, but the thing is solid with story. Couple ads there at the end, as expected.
No Babstar, sadly.
No, but that's one of those where doing the regular monthly book, trying to do an annual on top of that, for most artists, that's just, you can't do that.
Right.
I would have liked to have seen her in here in some capacity, even if it was just a page or two framing sequence or, I don't know, something.
I did laugh out loud at one point when she sees Grayson's butt as he's getting into the helicopter and does a double take. Like she recognizes it.
I did think that was funny.
That was very funny. And very harkening back to the Grayson book there, you know, because he's always shirtless.
Well, I also liked how they explained fairly well why Dick Grayson was trying to avoid Batgirl the whole time.
Yeah,
it's not just that she thinks he's dead, but she's observant enough and knows him well enough that even in disguise, she was likely to pick him out. You know, so I thought they addressed that issue fairly well in terms of the why he needed to stay out of sight. I think they could have sold the concept of why he felt he had to leave her thinking he was still dead a little bit better.
Yeah.
But for me, this was a very solid B. It was a good read. For me, if it had felt more essential to the main title, that would have helped. But it didn't hurt it not to feel that way. But I think that's what it would have taken to kind of rise it up a little further in my mind.
Yeah, that was really solid. I gave it a B+. I liked it a little more than you, I think. But yeah, a lot of story here. Really cool use of all the different art styles. And it really worked for me. And I liked the whole story.
Are you reading the monthly book?
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
But not Grayson.
You should be. I think it's a great book.
I've heard good things. I need to get back into it.
Did this entice you to check it out? Or
Yeah. I was getting bored with let's go hunt down human organs each week or each month. And I thought that was kind of a lame storyline and I got sick of it. So I know they're through that now. So And I know there's just kind of a twist with the spiral technology face thing going on. So I'm going to check that out.
Pick up the issue that just came out.
10? Number 10? Yeah.
That one, it would be a good one to get back on with.
Yeah.
It's one that could have ramifications elsewhere.
My brother's a big fan and has been chastising me for jumping off, so I need to get back on that.
Yes, you should. Shall we move on to our Marvel book?
Yeah, let's do that.
This is Thor's number 2, and that's Thor's plural. This is part of the Battle World stuff. This is written by Jason Aaron. We've got Chris Sprouse and Goran Suzuka. Did I get that right for the artist?
Yeah, I think so.
I'm still behind on my reading, as I kind of alluded to earlier. So I read Thor's number 1 just before reading number 2. My thoughts on the two issues, very similar. This is, I think, just a fun kind of a mashup of the Marvel Thor mythos with kind of a standard police procedural. And that concept in and of itself is just kind of a crazy one to me. I don't know who came up to it, but it's pulled off here surprisingly well. And I liked the use of the different Thors. We've got everything from the Ultimate version, Beta Ray Bill, kind of the classic version, the old version, the old Thor from the recent run, the Frog version. We got Storm. We got a few others kind of guest starring here. And as Easter eggs, those are fun. And they're different enough versions of the character that they interact kind of cool. And the basic case they're going after here is a serial murder of a single person, which is a very kind of cop drama kind of a thing. Ooh, we might have a serial murder here. With the battle world twist of every region seems to have the same damn people in it. So I liked how that played out. I thought it was a cool twist. There are a couple of versions of Thor that I was hoping to see in here, specifically the Thunderstrike version, which is really not Thor specifically, but another guy with a hammer. So that's he was Thor for a while, so I think that counts. And there are really a couple of different Thunderstrikes they could have used, but the classic is what I would have gone with. And the other thing that's working well for me here, and this is sheer supposition on my part for part of this, this seems to have strong potential story links with the pre-Secret Wars Marvel Universe, and it feels like it could have ramifications on the post-Secret Wars stuff. Who's dead? Why were they going after him? How's all this happening? It may or may not turn out to be that way, but to me, this is a fun use of continuity of the mythos that is built up in the Marvel Universe for the past couple of decades, taking it in just kind of a crazy direction with the police procedural aspect, and making something new out of it.
Yeah, I was really, really loving the first issue. I thought it was great, a great introductory issue. It really got you interested in the title. I don't think the second issue was as strong, but it was still good. Not as much happened as all the groundwork that was laying in that first issue. So, of course, it would suffer a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different continuity Thors in here, and I didn't try to kind of make sense of them all. You know, they're just all in the same room, and that was okay. It was fun. It was a fun premise, and I don't know that it's thought out as, you know, real cohesively, but that's okay. It's just another one of these SWA titles, so I don't really have that high of a standard for that sort of thing anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so still really fun, still holds up. The art's really cool. A lot of great interpretations of a lot of different Thors from a lot of different eras. And like TJ was saying on your trades episode, you know, Jason Aaron's really my introduction to Thor over a consistent time period, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so he does it better than anybody in my estimation. I really enjoy what he's done, and so this is just him kind of continuing to weave these tales. He knows Thor, he does a good job with this character, and he can have fun with multiple Thors across multiple timelines. He's already proven that with the Esad Ribic run. So
that's true. He had at least three or four Thors going at one time there.
Yeah. So I trust him to be able to stick this landing. And it's fun. It's not, I would say that first issue was an A, and this isn't quite that good. It's a B plus for me.
Interesting. For me, and this may just be because I read both of them pretty much, you know, again, well, not pretty much exactly back to back. They may have blurred together a little bit more in my mind. I was going kind of with an A minus for both of them.
Okay.
But I concede your point that the first issue did a lot more of the setup than this did. But I liked how this really, again, played homage to the Thor mythos that we've had over the years, some of the characters and stuff like that. It also, you know, built up the concept of kind of the ranks within the Thor Corps and those kinds of ideas. It's one of those that, I mean, I see what you're saying also about, is it, you know, completely brilliantly thought out? I don't think any of the Secret Wars titles, by and large,
are
bulletproof from that perspective. But I think the better ones, of which this is certainly one of them, really holds up to some scrutiny, if you want to put it that way. It has some Easter eggs, and if you don't get them, it doesn't lose anything. You know, it's something where part of what I think Jason Aaron is having success with the Thor characters is he's embracing the Thor-ness of those characters. He's not trying to make Thor into something Thor is not, whichever version you look at. The female one, the classic one, the old one, the, you know, whatever. He gets what works about these characters, and that's what I'm enjoying about this.
Yeah, halfway through Marvel's event, I am much more impressed with how they're pulling this off than I was halfway through the Convergence event. I really think that they really thought some of this stuff out and said, how can all this stuff work? How can it work interchangeably, standalone, yet be a mm-hmm. part of this larger event as well? And still, you know, they still had enough rooted in the Secret Wars event title, you know, Doom's still in charge and it's still his playground and they're just in it. And it's kind of cool that they exist in there like that and it works and it's something you can pick up and enjoy or not.
Well, and also what I'm enjoying about the Secret Wars event is they're taking the classic Secret Wars and certain aspects of it that are playing out here. You've got a hodgepodge world of different realms and stuff like that. We get that here, but in a very different way. You know, it's a reimagining of that story for the current time, setting, and level of continuity, both love and hate of continuity, I think, now. So, I mean, to me, what's impressive is not just that they're telling some great stories, that they're making these things to where Thor's here works as a standalone thing, yet also complements these other titles going on. But the fact the main Secret Wars title itself seems to have a plotline worthy of going on for as many issues as it has.
Yeah.
There have been a couple that Age of Ultron, it's like, aren't you done yet? So that was that. They're doing some really good stuff over at Marvel these days. I think this is up there with the top of the quality stuff for Secret Wars, where I would put this Secret Wars, Squadron Sinister, a couple others. Again, I'm still behind on my reading, so I haven't read all the first issues of all the different ones. I'm still trying to catch up on that.
Yeah, there may be a couple others that I just haven't sampled that are good. But yeah, I agree. There's some really good ones, standout titles in this. And the event itself is pretty strong. So
hey, there are a couple that are clearly cashing in and not so good. But those are, I think, more the exception than the rule.
Yeah. Yeah. At first glance, I said, no, come on. If you have this whole history to choose from and you're choosing Age of Ultron, one of the weaker of the events of the last recent years. And then I thought, well, maybe it's because they also want to give something recognizable to recent fans and new fans so that they don't all feel like it's way before their time. So
I think that's some of it. I think it's just a matter of where this stuff has fallen apart or is the weakest, in my opinion, is the mutant books.
Yeah.
They all seem to be hitting very similar themes. It's hard to distinguish the different eras of the mutant stuff. It all blurs a little more together than I would like it to. But I don't know how they could have avoided some of that.
Are you current on Where Monsters Dwell?
No, I don't think so. I think I'm an issue behind.
Okay. It's been good. I really enjoyed that one.
I am up to... Well, we'll get to that at the end. I was going to say, I'll catch up on one. Shall we move on to our other book?
Did we grade this one?
Yeah. Oh, I gave this one an A minus. You gave it a B plus. So yes, yeah, I think right. we that's did. Right. But thanks for checking.
Sometimes I do get us off on a tangent. Sorry about that.
It happens. So our other book is Hacktivist Volume 2, Issue 1. Nice of them to put the volume number clearly on the cover there. Appreciate it. This is by Boom Studios. It's by the Arkea now imprint. They used to be their own publisher. It is created by Alyssa Milano. It's written by Colin Kelly and Jackson Lansing. It's illustrated by Marcus Toe. I think Marcus Toe is doing a fantastic job here, by and large. I really enjoyed the first Hacktivist miniseries. I'm glad they did a second. I thought this was a very strong starting issue. Had some interesting kind of scary, if you really think about the ramifications, kind of the cyber terrorism plot line here, because it seems not necessarily trivial to do, but certainly within the realm of possibility. But man, a lot happens in this issue. And I think if you haven't read that first miniseries, you should be able to jump in here fine. That having been said, I would recommend reading the first miniseries. It took the whole social networking and activism stuff in a very interesting direction. It's a very fun kind of a world they've built up here. And this furthers it. It's clearly kind of later events. I don't say sequel, but another adventure in this world. Not entirely standalone, but not like it's just the other one did not end on a to-be-continued note that this is just pick it up.
Yeah.
They're different stories in the same world. Same players involved, etc. But I thought this was a lot of fun. It was a fulfilling read in a good way. it had a lot in there, and it wasn't just one of these issues I just kind of raced through and thought, well, geez, there wasn't much there. There was tons here. I liked it. How did it work for you?
Well, we were talking earlier, might have been offline, about how sometimes I miss a title, and so I don't get the entire run when I do my DCBS orders. And this was one of those where I read the first two issues, and then it fell off my radar for whatever reason, and I forgot to order the rest of it.
Ah.
So I only read the first half of the first volume. So I never got to finish a lot of this, the ending, and kind of know where this, why this is starting the way it is. But that being said, it did a good job as a just coming in fresh. You really don't need that. It does a good job of on-ramping you.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually thought that if you compare this first issue with the first volume's first issue, I know it's a while ago, but I think this is a little more interesting and pulls you in a little better, and it's a more polished creation here. I think the creator kind of was feeling himself around there on that first volume and getting their legs under them, and I think they're really doing them. They're much more professional in this one, and it really works on a lot of different ways and has some cool visual things in here with the storytelling that they're doing, and I think it's a lot better than that first issue was.
I would agree with that. I think the creative team as a whole has grown in the intervening time, learned some stuff, as any creative team would do during, you know, completing a miniseries. It's like, ooh, we could do things better. At least any good creative team that's trying to improve their craft. And I would say their craft is definitely better here. It was good before. I thought that was a good effort there. But yeah, I would say this first issue was much more fulfilling than I recall the first issue of the previous volume being, but it's also been long enough since I've read that I'd have to kind of reread to do a fair comparison.
Well, I'll just take a stab. I'm just taking a stab. I don't know.
No.
It's not fresh in my mind either, but if I recall it properly, this feels better. It feels stronger than that first one.
It feels like it's got more story in this issue than I recall that one having.
Yeah.
It ended feeling like it had covered more ground, which is funny because this is a 6-issue miniseries. I think the first one was only 4.
Only 4, yeah.
So they were further into the story in the previous one, but I think it was just a little bit of I don't want to say a smaller story. That doesn't seem right, and it's hard to judge since we only don't have the full one here. But this is one that if you're interested in, I don't want to say a spy story, but kind of a cyber spy story-ish sort of a thing.
Yeah, if you root for people like Anonymous when they try to take down corporations and stuff, this is a good book for you.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing that I think would make a fun movie or two. Do a movie of the first one, then do a movie of this one. So far, it seems to be, I think, worthy of that. I think that would be certainly in the cards and make for good movies.
It's a good companion book to something like Tithe.
Yeah, Image. Yeah.
You know, it's that same sensibility. You know. Little guys rising up, uprising, you know, taking down the big bad establishment.
I mean, the concepts of cyber terrorism, cyber activism, that kind of stuff. Tithe is a good comparison title. Think Tank, in some ways, is not entirely dissimilar either. Think Tank is a very different kind of a story, different approach to it, more sarcastic and whatnot, but similar sensibility rooted in science fiction that's surprisingly close to science fact. There's nothing here that's got ray guns or anything totally crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of what I find both fun about this and, frankly, a little scary. I can see some of the ideas here. It's like, you know, that would take some work, but it seems like it could be done.
Now, I think the colors are really stand out here as well. The colorist is Ian Herring. With Becca Kenzie, and they do an outstanding job. Like the color palette is like these muted greens and blues throughout, but then there's still pops of color. But I think they really thought the colors out on this, and it really complements the book.
Yeah, the colorist certainly was an involved part of the storytelling here. There are certain scenes that, again, there's one or two that have a lot of blues, a lot of greens, one or two that have got a lot of reds, and if you were to have had a colorist that, I don't say just kind of phoned it in, but just kind of, let's put the basic colors in there, didn't really give it much thought, it would have been a lesser book. And it's not one of those where the colors are shouting out, hey, look at me, but they strengthen the book.
Yeah, sometimes it seems like it's just spot color on raw pencils, some of the panels. And it really, and it just emotes an emotion, mm-hmm. you know, just a sea of red on some raw pencils, it seems like. And I'm sure it's much more sophisticated than that, but it really is effective and effective art. The team as a whole really did a good job. And I think for me it's better than that first volume kickoff was, and so I'm gonna get another B+. I think I'm straight B pluses today.
I think you are. I'm gonna give it another A-. I thought this was really good, very satisfying. I enjoyed it. It was one that, I'll be honest, when I was thinking about it earlier, I was very close to just giving it that A+, thinking, wow, this is great. But the more I thought about it, the harder time I had reconciling events at the beginning of this issue and events at kind of the, not the end of it, but about halfway through.
Yeah, as much as I really like the art, there are elements of this story that there is some murkiness. And part of that is because I didn't finish that first volume. But part of it is on the creator because, hey, it's not a number 5, it's a number 1. So you wanted to renumber, so introduce a whole new audience, your characters, you know, it's on them.
For me, just within this issue, I'm questioning if one character lied at one point. Because what I thought I saw at one point and what I'm hearing from the character at another point don't match. In my mind. And I could be misreading the events. So to me, that puzzlement is something that other issues will certainly clear up, I hope. But this is a strong start to the story. It's a worthy successor to the previous volume, and something that, again, I'm looking forward to more of.
Now, the red-haired female character that is testifying in front of like a Senate committee, she was in those first couple of issues, if I recall, right?
I believe so.
Yeah, and she seems much stronger and much more likable of a character here in this volume than she was in that first volume. But maybe she got stronger as the volume went on.
Again, I'd have to reread it. It's been long enough.
Come on, John.
As I recall, she was in an antagonistic role.
Yes.
To the leads, making her unlikable.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the problem that the Dr. Pulaski character had the second season of Next Generation for Star Trek. We've gotten to know Data and like Data, and she comes in and starts poking at him and being mean to him.
Oh, I gotcha.
And it's like, well, then we're not going to like you as an audience. And she lasted all of a season. So I think how creators set up the relationships between the main characters that we're supposed to like in most cases, sometimes we're supposed to not like them, and the surrounding characters colors our views of those characters, as it should. So, but it does have me thinking I maybe ought to go reread that first volume, because I recall it being really good. But again, some of these details, the one thing they could have done, and I like the way they did the credits on the inside front cover, so I'm not going to complain about that. There was no attempt to really recap and get me back into this world.
Right.
But as a first issue, it shouldn't need that either, and by and large, it didn't. But then it's like, oh, wait, who were these characters again? Where did they leave off? How did it go? I read too much to remember some of that.
And you know what? I applaud Boom because they just say right up front for the reader, hey, this is a miniseries. We're not scared of telling you that this is a miniseries. It's none of this stealth miniseries, and you know, we're pretending it's an ongoing, and it's really, but it was never going to be, and blah blah blah. I like the fact that they just, because I started in comics in the 80s when it was West Coast Avengers number 1 of 4, and miniseries were cool and they were fun to collect, and you were excited about getting that full collection, and they just seem to be, a lot of the publishers just treat them like they're horrible and they don't ever want to acknowledge that anything could be a limited series. So I like the fact that they just put it out there.
Well, I also respect the fact that they treated this like a true first issue.
Yeah.
They made it accessible. They went into it that way, and it were not just, well, we assume you read and memorized the previous stuff. So, I mean, I think they're doing a lot of the stuff right over there.
Boom is just really impressing me with just the depth and breadth of their line. It's really grown so much. And the stuff that they're putting out, so much of it is just high quality stuff. And after Image, then there are some weeks when when they're much more impressive than what Image Slate is. But after Image, they're really an impressive publisher to me.
They are. And one of the things I got in this shipment that is kind of worth talking about there is I got George Perez's Sirens Pen and Ink number one.
Oh, yeah, that looked really tempting.
The thing is gargantuan.
Yeah, yeah.
I got a huge box, and I don't mean just it's tall or whatever. I mean, it was wide, it was long, whatever. This thing is, I don't know, at least 11 inches wide and at least 17 inches tall or something.
It was only like $10 too, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was a bargain. It was $14.99 cover price. DCBS had a 35% discount, so $9.74. And this is as close as I'm going to get to owning George Perez original art and stuff, you know, as is conceivable or whatever, shy of spending way too much money. So again, they're doing some stuff like that I think is kind of cool. So I'm looking forward to you know, some of the other stuff coming out of Boom coming up. They've got the Power Ranger stuff. Trying to think what else they announced at San Diego, but a ton of stuff. They're one that I think as a publisher, Boom's had some ups and downs over the years. And their downs were never really particularly bad. It was just they're not at the high point they were at various points. And no publisher always stays up at that level either, so not to be surprising. And for me, when Mark Waid left as kind of their chief creative officer or editor-in-chief, whichever position he was in, it's like, man, you know, that's tough shoes to fill. But they've done well, both before, during, and after that. So.
Yeah, I've just been really impressed by their slate recently over the last 12 months. A lot of great stuff in there.
Yeah, definitely a publisher to keep an eye on. So I am still just behind on my reading.
What are you, about 250 behind?
No, I was about 200 or so behind last week. I think I am less than 100 now. But I don't know if that's just because my count's off or I'm actually picking up speed and catching up.
And you get your boxes on Friday?
I get my box on Friday. We're recording this on a Tuesday. So it's one of those that, you know, I'm trying to keep up enough that I'm not just staying as far behind as I was.
Yeah, you might actually be able to catch up about next week.
I don't know about next week because I've got a really, again, 100 or so comics. I'm going to have whatever comes out next week. That'll be another, hopefully, just 40 or so. But I've also got the next set of numbers coming out to crunch.
Oh, they come out Friday?
I think so.
Oh, that'll do it.
And then I've got the preview spotlight. I got a few other things going on. So it may still be another few weeks before I'm caught up, but I'm making some serious progress. I am everything in June is now red. I need to kind of put that information up on the forum at some point, and if I forget, somebody remind me. And then for that first week of June, I've only got a handful of items that are still kind of straggling because I'm current on the DC Universe. I'm current on Valiant. And I'm trying to think what else. Other stuff I'm still straggling behind on. Sometimes I just, hey, everything in this week, let's plow through it. Other times it's like, nah, I wanna catch up on this publisher. I want to finish the story or you know, what have you.
Yeah, that makes sense. You probably can't think of it by a month, but is there anything in June that really kind of stuck out to you? Or a group of titles that, you know, when you were reading it, you were just loving?
Let me answer that question a slightly different way as to what stuck out in my mind. I finally realized when I was reading, I think it was maybe I forget if it was the second or third issue of Starfire. I realized what it is about that title that's bothering me.
Okay.
I'm hearing the wrong voice for Starfire.
Okay. Who are you hearing?
There's the Starfire from the New Teen Titans, who, as far as I know, has never had a voice on cartoons or anything of the sort.
Okay.
Then there is the Starfire from the Teen Titans cartoon. And I'd have to look up which voice actress is doing her, and she does a great job. Nothing wrong with that. But that Starfire is woefully naive, very
ditzy, kind of, slutty.
I wouldn't go that way. I would go with bubbly, very, again, naive, innocent, yes. That sort of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
cannot understand. It takes everything kind of literally.
Yeah.
And that's very much the approach they're taking with this character in this title. And the minute I realized that and reread a couple of lines of dialogue in that voice, it's like, boom, that's the character they're doing. And
does it make it you enjoy it any better?
No.
Oh, okay.
Because I'm not watching Teen Titans Go, but the Teen Titans 5 seasons that I watched, I enjoyed, but it was a very Japanese anime-influenced kids cartoon that was kind of written down and childish. And not in a bad way, but in a way that I think is awkward and somewhat inappropriate for the version of Starfire they're doing in the DC Universe, in the comics. And it offends me to a degree to see what I thought was a really strong, powerful character, both in terms of the physical abilities or whatever, but also in terms of the personality that Marv Wolfman, George Perez, and others crafted during the 80s and after, basically getting supplanted by an adaptation of it.
Yeah.
Almost a caricature of it in some respects. And again, I enjoyed the Teen Titans cartoon for what it was, but what it was not was replacing the quote-unquote official versions in the comics. Now it kind of has.
There have been a couple of standouts in the DC realm, though, recently, which kudos to them. I think Prez is fantastic.
That one is surpassing all of my expectations for it, which...
Oh, well.
Oh, we're low. Oh, yeah.
Yes. I didn't realize it was a 1973 remake, but...
Totally different character.
Yeah, but I think it's a great comic and a great creative team. I think it's really strong. Two issues in now.
One thing before we get off that, though, that I noticed is this issue that just came out was... What issue number was that? Two. Maybe it's the solicits, actually, that I was seeing this in.
Okay.
It went from a 12-issue... issue 2 from last week was 2 of 12. The latest solicits, I think, have it as like 5 of 6.
Yeah.
So, how long it's going to last.
Issue 2 did feel a little rushed. Like, they went through an entire election in one issue that could have maybe worked better, stretched out a little more.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think it's very strong. I really like the voice, and I like the way it's satire. I like the way it treats our society. I think it's really cool.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
And I really think Secret Six picked up a lot of steam since its 4-month break between issues.
I had a hard time getting back into that book, and I was I liked the recent issue where members of the previous Secret Six showed up.
Yeah,
that was cool, but it made me go to Wikipedia and double check that was indeed the case. And there was a piece of information there. It's X happened. And I'm like, wait a sec, when did that happen? So I'm doing some research. Oh, it was in the third issue, whatever, yada, yada. And I'm like, I missed that entirely when I read it. And if they're going the direction I think they're going with one of the characters, like, I don't know about that. The delays really kind of was a stumbling block for me. It was too long, and the issues after it were not geared towards getting me back into that storyline. They were written as if no delay had happened.
It was an interesting. We had to read some of our weeks. We didn't have any big two publishers in there, mm-hmm. And it was weird because on the comics releasing July 1st, I didn't read a single DC book that week for the first time since I got back into comics in 2011, which I thought was very weird.
That is strange. I'm trying to remember what came out that week from DC. There was Action Comics, Batmite. Batman Arkham Knights, those I'm actually stockpiling until I can catch up with everything else. And I haven't read any of them yet, so I'll read them all at once.
Yeah.
Batman Beyond, Bizarro, Detective Comics. You didn't read Detective Comics even?
I haven't read it.
Oh, you've still got it, but haven't.
Yeah, I've still got it. It's one that just I've moved on since that week and moved well past it, a month past it, and I still haven't read it. So... That's just a really weird thing.
So the Bat Robot stuff not working for you?
No, it's not engaging enough for me to have to read it right away. You know, I don't feel compelled.
I can understand that. Again, part of the issue I'm struggling with at times is it's like, okay, I've got time to do some reading. Well, what do I want to read? And there are times where it's like, you know, well, this isn't the Superman I know. This Green Lantern's a villain. Well, which X-Men group is this? In what timeline? In what state? The stories are such that when I read them, I enjoy them, but I don't get excited just looking at the cover thinking, well, I've got to read that one right now.
Yeah.
And that is unfortunate. And if I'm feeling that with this whole stack of stuff, I can only imagine there were people at the store when those came out thinking, eh, maybe I don't need to get these.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's you don't, and other times you do, but they needed to sell it better.
But I am encouraged by some of the decisions DC's making, so I applaud them for taking some of these chances while still maintaining their line pretty consistently. And so I think there's some potential there, but it's kind of concerning that one of my favorites is reduced from a 12 issue to a 6 issue, but.
And that may not turn out to be the case. They may have just missolicited the one issue. Don't know yet. But it is a little bit of a cause for concern.
Yeah, that's pretty quickly to give up on it.
I would have to go look to see how it's selling. It may not be doing well enough to stick around.
30s, I think.
I'd have to go look it up, yeah.
Yeah.
Even 30s, though, isn't that bad. It's not, you know, top of the charts by any means.
Well, 30s for your first issue, and then the attrition downward after that is a problem.
Depending how the attrition is. If it's not too bad, that'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
This strikes me as the kind of thing that needs a couple issues to have a potential rebound around issue 4.
Yeah, I'm excited about issue 4 because word of mouth will have spread on this issue by then. Hopefully retailers listened and stocked accordingly.
It's one that on paper, it's like, really, they're doing prez? I don't know.
Oh, but yeah.
Then when you read it, it's like, oh, no, I see what they're doing. This is fun.
I had a green team reaction when I saw it, but it was much better than that.
Prez, Bizarro, Batmite, and one or two others all kind of fell into the, well, they're taking some chances.
Exactly.
Which is fine and good. Sometimes those work, sometimes those don't.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest, I would not have necessarily pegged Batmite as one that it's like, yeah, I'm really enjoying that. There are a few others I would have pegged. Yeah, if DCBS hadn't had the discounts, I wouldn't have gotten them.
Yeah, they had that number one bundle that sucked me in, so I got them all.
Yeah, I got enough of a completist in me. What can I say? Got to get some of the stuff. So yeah, like I said, I'm still behind, working on catching up.
But you're current with DC and Marvel or DC?
DC Universe, not on Marvel. Marvel, okay. Again, part of the inertia there is... There are just so many. Marvel's kind of a split bag. There's the stuff still happening in the Marvel Universe, and I'm trying to keep up on some of those things. Like, I read the latest Daredevil, loved it.
Mm-hmm.
Feel sorry for Charles Soule, who's going to do the next Daredevil volume. It's like, man, Mark Waid gave him a really tough act to follow. And then there's all the Star Wars, or the, not the Star Wars, the Secret Wars stuff. Star Wars is yet another branch of the Marvel stuff.
Yeah.
You
current on Secret Wars, or the Star Wars stuff?
No, I've gotten a little behind on that. I've had to kind of pick and choose.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's just, it comes down to what mood am I in. Do I want to just finish off a week? Because I've only got like 5 or 6 things left for that first week of July. But then the following week, I've probably got just a ton of stuff.
I am 4 issues behind on Hellbreak, and it's only 4 issues out. So at some point, I'm going to have to say, you know what? I'm not compelled enough to read this. Maybe I shouldn't be buying this comic.
What I do in those cases where I'm wondering, should I keep getting it or not? Before I order the next one, I make a point of reading it with
a
guy.
That's very good.
An eye towards, do I like it or not? Because I'll be honest, there have been a couple. It's like, you know, I've in the past let certain titles stack up because I was behind whatever. And it's one of those things. My next push will probably be either the Star Wars stuff or the Secret Wars stuff or the rest of Marvel. And then the indies may pile up or whatever. So I may get way behind on a couple of books. I'm 6 issues behind on all 6 issues of Batman Arkham Asylum, for instance.
Yeah.
But if I'm thinking, should I be buying this or not? I don't just assume since I haven't read it, it must suck. I make a point of reading it and determining, okay, I need to make a decision on this. Let me read this with that in mind. And I think that's just the better way to go.
Yeah, normally I just get sample that first issue before I decide if I'm going to keep continuing. But I like the creative team. I think it's Colin Bunn on Hellbreak. So, but obviously not enough to grab that and read it right away. So I've got some homework too.
I've had times where I'm intrigued by Solicit, but by the time it comes out, I've forgotten why I was intrigued.
Yeah.
And it's one of those where, again, is there the impetus to read it now? And that's not to say it's a bad thing. It may just be, you know, you've forgotten why you were getting it.
Wicked and Divine, did you catch up on that one yet?
Yes. Enjoyed it.
The guest artist, though, I don't think this team works with them when they're not together. I thought it was a huge drop off.
I thought the art quality was there, but my connection to the story was diminished.
Yes. Yes, it wasn't immersive, and it didn't have that same quality the Gillen McKelvey team has, and those two guys need to work together as much as possible.
Well, they're going to be doing the new Phonogram series.
Yeah, and that's why we have guest artists on Wicked and Divine, so they can do that.
In defense of the guest artist, I think the guest artist did a fantastic job, was a really good match style-wise, and nothing about that was bad or whatever.
No, it's not bad art. It's just not the art I was used to. And I think the story took a backseat.
It wasn't the art I was used to. It's, I think when Gillen and McKelvey work together, there is literally a certain magic there.
Yeah.
They jive really well. The story flows. They've got a cohesive vision, I think, or at least it comes across that way.
Yeah.
For all I know, they both despise each other and whatnot. I doubt that's the case, but who knows? Any other artist filling in is a fill-in artist. They're not one of the people who architected this. They're not one of the people whose DNA is baked into this book.
Yeah, I mean, so, there was interesting things that happened in that book, and the plot was moved forward in a variety of ways. So it was interesting things happening. It just, I wasn't blown away like I normally am with one of those issues.
I think what was missing, though, was a bit on the intangible side. It's not like they've gotten a fill-in artist I've seen some other cases where it's a fill-in artist. It's like, wow, this one just, from an objective point of view, the art isn't as good.
Right.
This one, I think the art was, again, hard to be up there with McKelvey and stuff, but it's not like it was a quantum level below or something like that. It was just missing that added something when you've got a creative team that has just worked together before and knows each other inside and out on how to work together. You know, again, to me, Wolfman Perez on the new Teen Titans is just so much better than Wolfman and somebody else.
Yes.
Or even Perez and somebody else. Those two guys were what created that book and made that book. Same here with Wicked and Divine.
And like you mentioned, when Wade and Samney leave Daredevil, oh my goodness, what a drop off that's going to be.
A Charles Soule's take it over, so I have high hopes, but...
But the 1-2 punch of Wade and Samney on art is not easily replicated.
I don't know who's going to be the artist.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think of who I would pair with Charles Soule that I think has that kind of chemistry, working chemistry with him.
I'd almost like to see them go in a different art style direction, like an Olive Red or somebody.
Oh, I don't know if I'd go that way, but I see what you're saying. There's a lot to be said for going in a different direction just so there's not that clear comparison of, well, you know, it's not what it was.
Yeah.
But I'm liking what it is, so I don't want that.
True.
That's the crux of the matter for me.
Yeah.
I don't want Wade's run to end, although it is.
Yes.
So we'll see how it goes. That's one of them when the first issue comes out. We'll probably be one of the books we review.
Can we be back in Hell's Kitchen by then, or just going to stay in San Francisco?
I don't know. I can see a number of different ways it goes. I have a hard time seeing how – well – I was going to say, I have a hard time seeing how they put him back into Hell's Kitchen and do that. But you know what? When Secret Wars ends, all bets are off.
True.
It could be as simple as he never left.
Yeah.
So, and that's something with Marvel that I'm wary about. I see a lot of things about these solicits coming out that make me think that there are going to be ramifications from Secret Wars, but Secret Wars is just as much a reset button for them. And that offends me to a degree. I spent a lot of time and energy reading these books. I'm emotionally involved to varying levels on these things. And if you just say, yeah, we were pulling your chain, who cares, this is where we're going now, it ruffles my feathers a bit. Mm-hmm. It feels like you wasted my time. And I don't like having my time wasted.
Yeah,
I've got other comics I could be reading. Ones that matter. Whatever that means. So, anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
Yeah, I think that does it.
Cool. Join us next week as we discuss Midnighter number 3 from DC, Age of Apocalypse number 2 from Marvel, and Long Distance number 3 from IDW.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.